Thanks, Ashley. There's a phrase much beloved by examiners in British universities, which is compare and contrast. What I'm going to do this afternoon is to apply these verbs to the Russian language as it was firstly in the period around 1800 and secondly some 200 years later around the turn of the present century. It's always seemed to me that if you take the various periods of upheaval to which the Russian language has been subject over the last 300 years or so, it's precisely these two that offer the most scope for an exercise of this nature. And what makes the nature particularly valid, in my view, is it can be carried out in at least three separate dimensions. I'm going to concentrate on three dimensions today. You can actually probably think of several more. So these are, first, the different types of direct and indirect linguistic influence. Second, the linguistic controversies engendered by this influence. And third, questions of what I've described as linguistic propriety and linguistic ownership. The key factor that unites the beginning of the 19th century and the beginning of the 21st century is the great range of linguistic influence. There is a tendency at the time, both then and now, to concentrate on direct borrowings, since these are the most visible results of linguistic influence. But equally important, and in the long term perhaps more important, if only because they're more insidious, are the various other forms of influence. These can be summed up as follows. Calques, extensions of meaning of already existing words to acquire new meanings. Phraseological calques and modes of expression. Changes in forms of address. If the period of French influence saw significant expansion in the use of the pronoun voit to address a single person, at least among the polite classes, at the present time there's a decline in the use of the patronymic, both when addressing people and when referring to them. This is generally attributed to the influence of English. I think actually there are other less directly foreign factors that are also relevant here. There's also then the sphere of grammar. In fact, the influence of English on the grammar of present-day Russian is relatively slight. It probably doesn't go much beyond giving plural forms to some singularia tantum and some unusual word order patterns. It's certainly less pervasive than the French influence on Russian grammar in the earlier period, when there were, for example, changes to use of the genitive case, the use of the infinitive, and the use of conjunctions such as shtobwy. The reason for this difference seems fairly clear. Over the last 200 years or so, the grammatical structure of Russian has become much more highly standardized and codified, so there's actually relatively little space now for exotic innovations. On the other hand, the French influence of 200 years ago can be seen as the culmination of a long creative process, which, over 100 years or so from the end of the 17th century, had led to the syntax of written Russian becoming essentially a different system from the syntax of the spoken language. Interestingly, the tendency now is for this difference to become reduced and for the two systems to reconverge. Another reflection of linguistic influence can be found in the appearance of what I've called false forms. False Gallicisms in the earlier period, false Anglicisms at the present time. Two false Gallicisms that come to mind are dirigeur, conductor of an orchestra, and the rather later stageur, someone who's, most of you will note as a foreign student. There have been others, I think. Certainly, there are quite a lot of false Anglicisms from the present period. My favourite one is face control, security, night clothes. Though, somewhat counterintuitively, this word seems to have been borrowed from Greek in the late 1990s. But other examples include showman, showwoman, business lady, digger, slice bar, and masky show. And interestingly, face control and masky show have actually found their way back into English. I'm not aware that any analogous development has taken place with false Gallicisms. I'd be a little surprised. There is a further influence related to language, further factor, sorry, related to language influence. Some time ago, I took it upon myself to try to define the different functions that English fulfilled in relation to Russian during the 1990s, and I calculated four of these. One, as a direct source of new elements. Secondly, as a model for imitation. Thirdly, as a general symbol of something that is foreign. And fourthly, as an element of language games, such as bilingual puns, for example. With the further point that for the last two of these, as a symbol of the foreign and as an element of language games, what you actually needed was not the real English language, but something that was perceived as English by other Russians, which isn't necessarily the same thing. If we go back in time 200 years, there's no doubt that French fulfilled the first two functions. That's not a problem. It's plausible that it could have fulfilled the third function, that is a general symbol of foreignness. But I can't think of a specific example, and others may be able to. And it is conceivable, but I think rather less plausible, that it could have fulfilled the fourth function. Although, on second thoughts, since one of the functions of bilingual puns, and one of those examples, all the best bilingual puns are obscene, is actually to disguise obscenities. It wouldn't seem totally far-fetched that French elements might have been used in that function, if only in conversation or private correspondence. And then again, the other question is whether the distinction that I drew between English, the real language, and English, what is as perceived as English, or what passes off as English in Russia, whether that distinction applies to French in the period around 1800, again, is something which I don't know, which others may have a view. It is incidentally also the question of whether there are functions that French fulfilled around 1800 which English doesn't fulfil. I didn't go into this, but I have noticed on the programme that there is a paper on the use of French as a conspiratorial language. And that, I think, is not a function, as far as I know, that English tends to fulfil at the present time. Turning to the second dimension, that of responses to the linguistic changes, the differences, I think, are more striking than the similarities. During the present period, there's certainly plenty of controversy, but there isn't any real debate. It's extremely rare to come across a principled defence of the changes that have been taking place in Russian over the last two decades. What you have instead is an argument conducted between those who are totally opposed to the changes and those who accept them more or less through gritted teeth, on the grounds that linguistic change is inevitable and there's not much you can do about it. There is another point to make, which is that those who oppose the changes totally do so from a position that I think is an ambiguously conservative. What they want, and very often they say this, is that they want the Russian language to go back to how it was before 1991. The earlier period, I would suggest, differs in both of these respects. In the first place, there is a genuine controversy. You can, I suppose, take a somewhat cynical view and say that in this, as in most linguistic controversies, the various arguments put forward amount to not much more than rationalisations of the position that this is what I like and this is what I don't like. But if you allow for this qualification, what you find is that both the proponents and the opponents of the novice lock do mount principled defences of their respective positions. So that in contrast to the post-Soviet disagreement, what have been put forward in the earlier period are two contrasting proposals for the future development of the Russian language. And this brings us to the second difference, because it seems to me difficult to describe the linguistic views of Krzyzkov and the other opponents of the novice lock as being conservative, because they are not really they're not seeking the maintenance or the restoration of some sort of status quo. Uspensky and Lotman, who have already been mentioned several times here, say of Krzyzkov that he wasn't a traditionalist but a utopian, utopist. I would say that whatever else he may have been in all his other spheres of activity, in relation to the language controversy, he could perhaps best be described as a radical reactionary. Rather, perhaps, in the way that Margaret Thatcher was, at least in her own self-image. One of the reasons for using the word reactionary is that Krzyzkov does, in a literal sense, react, in that his proposals are a response to the novice lock. The novice lock is open to foreign, especially French, influences. It keeps the language within narrow stylistic bounds by excluding forms that are perceived as excessively high or excessively low, and is based, at least theoretically, on the principle Pisatskat Gavariat. Krzyzkov's model, on the other hand, takes the opposite. His model is puristic. It seeks to use, albeit in a very carefully ordered fashion, all the resources of the language. And it uses Church Slavonic as a point of orientation and as a resource, particularly for vocabulary and perhaps syntax. And in so doing, it would increase the gap between the spoken and written language to a point that might potentially amount to diglossia in the Fergusonian, if I may put it so, rather than the Burkean sense of the term. Well, Shishkov may have had his shortcomings as a linguist, and as someone who was mocked by Pushkin and was notorious for his rigidly conservative political views, he never really took much chance of being taken seriously throughout most of the 20th century. His model is generally perceived, possibly not with total accuracy, as the road not taken. But perhaps the time has come to offer him at least a partial rehabilitation and to give his model some serious consideration. And among the most interesting features of this model are the similarities it bears to the model that was adopted for the development of Czech in the early part of the 19th century. The model for Czech is based on purism. It takes as its reference point a prestigious literary form, the language of Czech literature of the 16th century, and its adoption leads, at least for some part, in some parts of the Czech-speaking world, to a significant split between the spoken and the written language. I'm not the first person to point out these similarities, and I suspect they're not entirely coincidental. What they suggest, however, is that the question that might best be asked is not what was wrong with Shishkov's model, but why did a model that worked for Czech not work for Russian? And we go slightly off the topic, so I don't spend too long in contemplation of this problem. But there are two possible answers that come to mind. The first is that Shishkov simply came along too late. He was reacting, and it's one thing to set the direction of a language variety that's in the process of formation. But it's quite a different thing to change the direction of one that already has a substantial existence. The other seems to be that Shishkov overestimated the threat posed by French. The parallel between German in Bohemia and French in Russia turned out not to be valid, and for a reason, a mixture of linguistic, cultural and political reasons that possibly can no longer be disentangled, Russian absorbed the French influence and survived reasonably intact. In an early consideration of today's topic, I drew attention to the possible influence of the hostilities between France and Russia on the language question and expressed the hope that there was no necessary reason for history to repeat itself. Well, it hasn't yet, though it is worth asking whether to what extent the return to Cold War attitudes and the growth in anti-American sentiments condition the influence of English on present-day Russian. In any event, those who at the present time belong to what I said just earlier was the gritted teeth tendency use the examples of the Petrain period and the period of French influence to demonstrate that Russian will in due course emerge safe and sound from its period of intense contact with English. I don't want to sound too alarmist, but it does occur to me that there is a question which I didn't go into for this paper, partly because I didn't think of it in time, and partly because it is very complicated, which relates to the loss and gain of functionality of language. And here I think the parallels may be less comforting for present-day Russian. As I suggested at the beginning, the third dimension of this comparison is concerned with attitudes to language propriety and language ownership. Up until the end of the Soviet Union, the practice in Russia was generally comparable to that which has been adopted over the years for French. The bounds imposed on linguistic acceptability were made relatively narrow. There is a single version of what is correct, which allows for only minimal geographical or social variation, and ownership of the language, in the sense of who determines what is and what is not correct, is concentrated in the hands of a select few. In the case of Russian, this probably meant in practice those who produced officially approved dictionaries and school textbooks, as well as the various works of reference aimed at the army of editors who controlled what appeared in print or what was broadcast. Indeed, it's tempting to argue that for a number of years the Russian language was, to all intents and purposes, the personal property of one Dietmar Eliashevich Rosenthal, who was the author or editor of most, or well, high proportion at any rate, of these works of reference. It is, it must be said, uncertain to what extent these attitudes are directly influenced by French practices. The answer is probably not very much, and they probably owe more to Soviet approaches of control and good order. Nevertheless, it is possible to discern some of the origins of this approach in the attitudes of the proponents of the Novi Slog, and in particular the desire to keep the language confined within narrow bands of propriety, something that was particularly characteristic throughout the period of the Rusky Literatura and the Yazyk. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the French approach is replaced by one that's much more akin to that of English. Authority is displaced so that norms become uncertain, and a single universal standard is replaced by multiple standards that are dependent on context. The language becomes much more inclusive. In terms of ownership, Russian becomes, like English, a perfect communist language, in that it's owned collectively by its users. Here too, there's no necessary reason to suspect the direct influence of English. The changes that can be accounted for perfectly satisfactorily by political and cultural developments that have taken place within Russia and elsewhere in the Russian-speaking world. There does, however, seem to be one final parallel. If what is in some ways a peculiarly Russian construct, the Russian literary language, can trace its beginning to the period of French influence at the beginning of the 19th century, it seems to come to the end of its existence, at least as it's been traditionally understood, in the period of English influence 200 years later. Thank you.